Good afternoon. Today is March 21st, 2018, and we are in the Raven Landing conference room. And I'm with Virginia McDermott, who has consented to give an interview to be used for the Raven Landing Resident Stories Project and to be recorded at the University of Alaska. We'll start with a little biographical information. Can you tell us where and when you were born?
I was born in Massachusetts in a city called Waltham. There was a hospital I was born in. And that was on June 17th, 1929.
And is that where you grew up?
And as it worked out, my family spent about 12 years. They were there until I was about 12 years of age. We lived in Weston, but I was born in Waltham, which was a city next door in Massachusetts, you know, down the road a piece, as they say. And lived in that small town, very small town. It was one of those old-fashioned upscale towns where people like the Sears and Roebuck people lived. And so it was a very unusual growth period for a little girl. And luckily I had a mother that reassured me that that was not going to be my lifestyle.
Good for you. Is there any stories about your parents or your siblings that you want to tell us?
I think my grandfather, I'll start with my Swedish grandfather, because he was just a very unusual human being. He came over from Sweden with his wife at that time. I think they were married. I don't think they got married here, because they came over together in those days. Through Ellis Island, but when he came as an immigrant, he came with his credentials as a bricklayer. So landing in New York, and somehow they migrated. I think there may have been a Swedish community that they knew about in Waverly, Mass, where they moved to. So he was able to work right away and establish enough of a background of money. I don't know if he came with any or not, that I don't know, but all I know is that they lived a very solid middle-class lifestyle because of his capacity to be, a professional in those days. He helped to build the Boston skyline until he was 73 years old. He was one of those physical tigers, really. Uh-huh. One of those human beings that was just very lucky. And my grandmother was the typical, Swedish grandmother who spent all her time in the kitchen. Okay, or washing the floors. That was the way those women spent.
Uh-huh.
I'll add one thing about my grandfather now, which I think is an interesting part of it. Starting when I was 5 years old, because we lived nearby and we'd go every Sunday for dinner, and I was the first grandchild, and he had a Swedish accent, but he had learned English, and he made a place for me to be down in the cellar because he had all these tools and everything. And he knew, little kids like to poke around and look. And every Sunday night he'd come down, he'd have something to say. But there was one thing he always said, and talk about repeating yourself. He'd look at me and shake his finger caringly, seriously, and say, "Virginia," with his Swedish accent, "don't you ever forget there is nothing more important than a union," because he was a union worker. And he was out several nights a week working for the unions. He was young and strong, and that kind of thing. But isn't that? He started when I was five.
It was important to him. Very important to him.
That his grandchildren should grow up with that respect for the union, and the what benefits would come with a lot of hard work.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's all I'll say about that now.
Can you tell us what brought you to Alaska?
Oh, that's easy. I was abducted.
Yes.
Yes. My husband passed away. It would be probably, 6 years ago, something like that. But anyway, so I did the usual things any woman does, Luckily, we had a wonderful dog, and my dog was my only companion. All my other relatives had moved on to the next journey. And
did you have children?
Yes, we had two children.
Okay.
Yes, we had lost one when he was 28. One of those accidents, he was hit by one of those great big tractor-trailer cars, you know, that carry everything. And our daughter was the one that moved up here. She ran away when she was, she ran away 22 years ago with a wonderful man who was interested in science and, you know, accumulated all his degrees, a PhD, Dr. Richard Boone. And what happened was, after a certain length of time, they'd been married, they had three children, he was always looking for some way to expand his consciousness and his opportunities. And at the University of Alaska, he was hired as a research scientist. So he was very happy, and I put on 30 pounds and, and cried, you know, when they left. The day they left. I handled it, but that was my body reaction. And so that's how she got here. So 22 years she's been here. And so when my husband passed away, she gave me about, you know, 3 years to get everything in order. I had no intention of coming up here because all my professional friends, I was a teacher, I did all kinds of networks and things. I'd been in the same house, the same man for 60 years. 60 years? What neighborhood? I mean, oh, you know. And but I came. I just made the deal with her that there's no way I'm living with you because you're never home. She does the drums, you know.
Steel drums.
Yeah, she's Molly McDermott. Yeah, I'm sure you've seen her a few. So that's my daughter, and she's wonderful.
I saw you at the concert.
Oh, okay. I giggle and I laugh and I think, but I remember looking at her and saying, "I'm not living with you." But and she said, "That's okay. I'll see if I can find a place for you." So, all right. And but at any rate, if you can imagine being brought to the lap of luxury. When you being abducted to Alaska, this I did not expect, this gift. But synchronicity is my favorite word, and it worked out beautifully. Okay.
So regarding your career, can you tell us what led to it and what your career was?
Oh, that's the.
Is that the part you need to read?
Oh, I think I really should. Yeah, because I had to reduce it to lowest terms. I really did. Okay. Let's see. The two first words would be synchronicity and destiny. Growing up, I never had, you know, lots of people say, I want to be a nurse, I want to be a teacher, I want to be a doctor, I want to be a typist, I want to work with numbers. And I never had any of those because I didn't have a highly developed sense of gift of being able to see pictures in my mind. Most people, I didn't realize it until I was in high school, but everybody, most people, can see pictures in their head when they close their eyes. I can't. I never could. I didn't know about it until I got talking to my friends in high school. And then I really knew there was something wrong with me, and I knew I was an oddball, but I never knew why. And so I always worked hard, and I would force myself to learn through saying things out loud and getting it through my ear, you know? So I did okay in school. I never failed anything, but... It was rough. So synchronicity and destiny. So I never had, how could I be a nurse? I can't remember. I can't. How could I be? I never had any idea who I was or where I was going. And it was always had inside. I was always like, who am I? Where am I going? You know. Anyway, I had a wonderful mother. My mother was just. She didn't. I don't think we never talked about the fact that I couldn't see, but she did tell me that I had fallen down the stairs when I was about 2 years old. That could have been why. It doesn't make any difference why I'd be deal what you get, because I got a lot of other gifts. Okay, so what happened in high school was, I'm doing math one day in the class, and this particular day wasn't different from any other day. I turned around and asked my friend if I was doing it right. It was algebra, junior in high school, in Waltham. We had moved to Waltham. And, my golly, do you know what? You know, and she said, of course you're doing it right. You're always doing it right. Well, anyway, that week, the math teacher came up to me and said, Virginia, would you walk down to the office with me? And I said, sure. And I said, uh-oh, what did I do wrong? Because I never cheated. That would never my mother and I know I would never have cheated. And they said to me, you know, Virginia, we think we're going to let you drop math because you are having a little trouble with it. And I said, well, I'm passing it. She said, yes, but you don't really need it. And I said, I don't. This is back, you know, born in 1929. Education did not have people who would help you with math and science and things. And they said, no, you're not going to need it. I'm not. And you know what they did to me? They said, well, the thing was, I couldn't see it. I couldn't see pages to remember anything. But I could draw circles around everybody. I never thought anything of it. I just could. And, you know, senior year, I did all the basic drawings and all the yearbook and stuff. But it was never any big deal because it was so easy for me. And they said, well, you're not going to need it because... Now, they never said the word just, but they might as well have, the way they said it to me, that you're going to art school. But they said it with the attitude of, you're just going to art school. You know, that whole nonverbal attitude. Kids get that. Mm-hmm. Kids are very sensitive. And I saw that and sensed that as though it wasn't that important. And that added to my sense of, who am I? Where am I going? When am I going to go to art school? Well, anyway, as it worked out, and I'll never know how it happened. This is so, nobody else has ever had this happen that I've ever spoken to. My father left for the service. He went in the service. My mother has an apartment, just a little three-room place. I have one younger sister who's 8 years younger. And that's it, just the three of us. And all... My mother had said something about, you're fine. And then about 20 minutes later, the doorbell rang, and somebody came. It was a representative from Boston University telling me I had a scholarship to Boston. They came to my house. I'll never know how it happened, because I don't know who or what or when I was, but I didn't go to the office to ask. I just said, oh. It was an interview, but they wanted to see my work and that kind of thing. But somebody set it up, and I'll never know who or what or when, because I never asked. I asked a lot of questions in those days, but that I didn't. My mother was just so thrilled and everything else, because we didn't have much money at all. And we lived in a little, at that point, we were in a little three-room apartment. And so I did. I went to BU, and I spent my 4 years there, And I thought it was really fun. I loved drawing. I loved painting. I loved jewelry making. I loved clay. I loved it all. I didn't know what I wanted to do with it. I didn't want to be an artist. I didn't want to be an artist. I didn't want to stand behind an easel all the time. And I didn't, you know, or be a sculptor, although I loved doing it. And so when I graduated with all good marks and everything like you do when you work hard and you love what you're doing. And I was so different from everybody else was talking about what they were going to do with it. I didn't want to be a commercial artist either. And yet I could draw like crazy. So I graduated from Boston University, and I didn't have anybody special, no male in my life that I was looking for. In fact, I didn't want to get married. I wanted to see the world, as kids say, but I never thought I would ever see the world. But I wanted to do more than just get out of school and get married. And what happened, basically, was that, my decision, I did not want to be an artist behind an easel. I did not want to do commercial art. No ideas, just questions. Who am I? Where am I going? What am I going to do? And somehow, something came together for a job. Well, I got to get a job. I can't just not work. So I kept looking, and I finally found a job working at Raytheon in Watertown, Massachusetts, which I could get there on a bus, as a technical illustrator working with the engineers. And I figured I could tolerate that because I knew I wasn't going to do it forever. I was going to do it to bide time. And in the meantime, I got, you know, at that age, I've got an apartment in Boston when I got the job with, a couple of friends in Beacon Hill. So they were good, they were good times, basically, because the engineers were really fun to interact with. And they were, and you know what, when you work with the engineers on one of those places like Raytheon, you have a huge, big drawing board like this. It's on an angle, and you have rulers and triangles, and, you know, they tell you what to do, and you do it. It was a nice social environment. I think that's why I was happy temporarily. But at any rate, what happened basically was I was very fortunate. Along came this man called named Joe McDermott. And the crazy thing, the way I met him was that I was in kind of a job earlier, just after I graduated, working on the beach in Nantasket at one of those places where you serve liquor and food and everything. And my job was, my father said, he was the manager of that one for the summer. You have to be the hostess with the mostest, young lady. I said, what? I guess the hostess with the mostest. Get up those evening gowns that you had in college and stuff that you made. So I'm walking around. That's the last thing in the world I was that type of girl. Ever, ever, ever. Sure, I made evening gowns. I wanted to go to the junior prom and stuff like that. So anyway, I'm standing around, and this girl comes. I meet this girl who's working, waiting on a table across the way. And she knows the people I'm working with, and they all get together. And so they invite me over to chit-chat whenever, you know, between customers, da da da. And, my job was this. I was supposed to walk around, the hostess of the Moses, lift people's glasses up to see how much is left and say, can I refill that? I did it, but, anyway, I didn't drink in those days. I think I just started when I went to dinner or something. This girl that came over, her brother came to see her, and he was talking in the group, so on and so forth. I didn't think, but I just met him. And then next time I saw her, she said, my brother would like to meet you. So he came, he met me, he made a date. And what happened was really weird. We made a date, and I'm not people that never stood anybody up, but something came up and I couldn't keep the date, and it was meeting him someplace else. I didn't give him my phone number. He didn't ask, I don't think. So I figured, I didn't do it on purpose, and I feel badly. But I met her on the bus 3 months later, going down to see my mother and father in that town where I'd worked that summer. And she said, where are you? My brother's been looking for you. And I said, X, Y, and Z, what happened? And so I gave her my phone number. He called me. We went out, and he's the one I married. Isn't that weird? Synchronicity? Mm-hmm. Synchronicity? And, it turned out, I thought he was an interesting person, but he was 10 years older, and, I did go out several times, and I thought he was interesting. But as I wrote down here, I think I can remember it. I guess my memory's broken. I wasn't sure if it would or not. But he was an optometrist already. He was established. He was 10 years older. He was already on the school committee. He was not a runner-arounder with women. He'd never been married. He'd been so serious. But he was his focus, his gift, varying gifts that everybody gets. He was an activist. He was already an activist in his early. I was 24. He was 34. Yeah, he was already an activist. So, and he was doing things like volunteering at the clinic, and he was one of those givers by nature. So that was my gift. And the more I went out with, not only that, he sensed that I'd never had any opportunity. This so happened in my family. My mother was the only one that spent all the time and did the wonderful job of being a parent. My father was so busy, he was elsewhere all the time. So I never got to go, to zoos and things like that, like a lot of kids did. But at any rate, can you imagine? She used to say, Virginia, go get the dolls. Let's go out and sit under the trees and have a tea party with the dolls, and we'll make the dishes out of acorns. Isn't that creative?
Yeah, really.
That's
sweet.
The way she was. I mean, she made up for it in so many hundreds of creative ways. So anyway, I guess I got that far. Commission. Oh, he was on the mayor's. Yeah, he evolved into being on the mayor's commission for human rights. There was no end to right up to the time. He died at 92. I was driving him because he couldn't drive anymore to all the different things that he was doing. So I was very fortunate, very, 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 very fortunate. So that, but now in that time, because I was synchronicity surrounded me with this kind of a human being who couldn't help but want to expand other people's consciousness and be helpful service. And he realized that, I got to see all the zoos in the New England area. I got to travel. I got to camp. I got to learn all about nature, visit everything. And he knew everything about. He was not a biologist, but he loved absorbing everything about nature and sharing it. And when you become a camper with a an old Volkswagen camper, you're always on the run. We did this with about 2 kids, 3 years. So with that kind of consciousness expansion, and then when things would come up, what are you going to do? I don't know what I'm going to do. Well, synchronicity sometimes jumps into your path, and you're lucky when it's good. When our daughter was ready for dance lessons, there was a couple that had moved from New York, and they were both professional dancers in the big place in New York, and they decided they didn't want that lifestyle to bring kids up in, so they came back to Quincy, where they lived. My husband's office was across the street. They opened up a dance studio on the second floor, and it had a stage, and I don't know what it was before, but so that was the obvious place I was going to bring our little girl for dance lessons. And she was, 8 years old or seven, I don't remember what. So who do these people turn out to be as it evolved? Their synchronistic path had already been determined by their genetics when they looked at each other and left New York to come back to Quincy and have this studio. He is a very creative man, and he developed a unique way of choreographing and teaching it very simply. And I was, tell me. Well, I got to know them very well. They got to be best friends in a way. And along the way, he was observing with his middle school kids when he would give them this very simple new pattern for choreographing, that the kids were telling stories about their lives. And, of course, this was just beginning to be sensitive process to be observed 50, 55, 60 years ago. And I was right there in his room when he wanted to have somebody to talk to what he was observing, and have a friend who you share this stuff with. My husband and I were very lucky, and he said, I'd like to have an experimental group. Would you guys be in it? Of course. The first thing we know, we're in the group, and we're doing basic, not dancing, believe me, but basic choreographic compositions. And it was so simple. I mean, I could sit in the chair and do it. And he was so sensitive, he could tell that the kids were telling stories. And when he would pursue not breaking into their privacy, but when they would have an opportunity to talk about what they were doing and why they were doing it, it all connected. His name was Al Pesso. His wife's name was Diane. They developed, out of that dancing school, a worldwide, this is unbelievable when you think of it, and the synchronicity that we were so lucky to be part of it and have that understanding, which helped me go forward to where I went with my gifts. Psychomotor therapy. He ended up teaching at one of the Boston colleges, but ultimately, he evolved into creating a technique called psychomotor therapy, and it became worldwide. He was doing workshops after doing workshops at Harvard and doing workshops and the business executives in Boston. I mean, time went through. He did workshops in Israel, in Europe, and at the end of it, they wanted him to come over to Japan to do. But he went and died on me. He died. He was the same age as I was.
So were you working with him during that time?
I never worked with him, no. I was the parent of his wife's students. They're both dance teachers. But we got to know them very, very well. So being in a workshop, I learned to understand the process. Mm-hmm. And the process was obviously therapeutic. But if you've internalized anxiety, you know this. We all know anxiety in your muscles. And you've held it there because you can't talk about it. There's no space where it's safe to talk about it. It stays there. And you pay a price in different ways. And it's not unusual. Most human beings have some degree of tension that they carry, but others have a lot, an awful lot. And so we went through enough workshops with him just to understand the process. And one of the things one of the techniques he created, which was kind of crazy, to release that anxiety that's accumulated in the muscles and everything. I'll never forget this one. I thought it was so bizarre at the time. He says, okay. And then he had us do it too. I want you to think about and reflect on things that you know you've internalized now that really have made you mad and weren't really talkable. You know, people don't talk about those things, the two things that happened when you're growing up. For me, it was being beaten by my father. I mean, so mm-hmm. it was easy for me to find something. And even though he was a wonderful man, a wonderful human being, he wasn't perfect. And very creative, too. Anyway, so he would say, okay, take turns, and when you're ready, and we'd be the group of adults even sitting on the floor like you'd have the kids cross-legged, I want you to reflect as much as you can on the memory of how that bad memory came to be and why you've never talked about it. Just reflect on it. And I want you to begin and allow yourself to feel the feelings coming up of how you felt at the time. Because you weren't smiling, that's for sure. And you weren't giggling. You were angry. I want you to get in touch with that anger. Relate it to that experience. And get up and walk across the room, that corner over there. I want you to pick up an imaginary atom bomb and crash it on the floor. And growl. So you would end up expressing, you know. So he had little kinds of strategies like that. They weren't all intense. That was the most intense. But you can imagine the kids loved that one. The adults were a little bit, huh? But we did it.
So later on, did you go back to work?
No, that's what I'm getting at. Because of the learning experiences that I had with Al Pesso and Diane, then as what happened was, because of my interest in the arts, I was interested, because I didn't get any in school, what the early cultures did in terms of seeking expression of their awe, A-W-E, of all of the beauty and the wonders of the world, especially in the coast of Africa or in India or any of the, you know, the beautiful dances and art and compositions of anything that could be made with hands, mind, or music and dance. And so what I did was I pursued that. I wrote it this way. Because of my interest in art history, the pursuit of understanding ancient gods of early cultures became a pursuit which led, where did I go from there? Ultimately, to our relationship with the First Unitarian Church in America where we lived, which was in Quincy, Mass, where the two Adams presidents and their wives reside in their classic granite coffins in the basement of the church for public visiting, and people come from Boston on buses, and, you know, they stop, they go in, they get the whole history of, you know, the early years of the Adams and Jefferson and the rest of it. And that is particularly meaningful to me because our women's group in my 50s, we got special permission from the minister. We were a very serious group of expanding our consciousness about early goddesses. And he gave us permission when we asked for it. We could reverently walk through the main church building, the main church room where services are held, and then go downstairs with candles and reverently sit on Abigail's tomb to be inspired, concentrate on her and her contribution. So weren't we lucky to have that kind of an experience?
It's pretty neat.
Yeah, we used to go into the woods and do all kinds of, you know, things like that as a women's group. And see, that's why it was so hard for me to leave and be abducted up here. Cause,
all that history.
Yeah. Anyway, so I evolved in that community. I don't know how it ever happened. All I know is that because I was a question asker, I guess, to the professional role of director of religious education. That was my second career. I only did it for 4 years, but it took, you know, and that was absolutely awesome. That was such a gift, and I don't think I ever got over, why me? You want me to be the director? So they
director
sent,
of religious education.
Yeah, for the, you got, you know, preschool through high school. Huh? Me? Anyway, what happened basically was that I did it, and I thoroughly and completely enjoyed it, and finally accepted the fact that I could do it because I would take all the workshops I could summers going off to the Ferry Beach, I guess that's what it was called, I can't remember now, yeah. Workshops in the summer to work with the professionals, and that gave me the self-confidence to And they gave me the self-confidence.
So after those 4 years, did you continue with the church?
No, because I decided, having that experience, along with Al Peso's experience of expanding my consciousness, made me curious about what was evolving then in dance therapy, music therapy, and art therapy. I didn't take them because I needed them. I took them because I was curious what they could offer me. Yes, personally, everybody can grow through those experiences. It isn't that I went and took all those as therapies and paid for them, but I did as much investigating as I could. And I was just somebody that was open to it, and synchronicity and genetics, it was my path. And finally, it was getting to dawn on me. But yeah, you're an oddball, but you're an oddball in a funny way, and it's okay. It's okay. You're going to make a contribution with who you are. So I decided to go back to school and get the education courses. And when I went back to BU, and I told them what was happening to me, basically, in terms of my interests, how they'd expanded beyond just teaching kids how to draw. Because when I was at BU, they invited us into a classroom to demonstrate what an art teacher would do, and maybe some of us would like to be art teachers. And I went in, and I was horrified because they were drawing on the board and having us copy it. You know, taste. So, you know, teaching was never even an option, let alone standing in front of an easel all day. So anyway, it got so crazy. So when I did, I went back to school. I went into BU, and I told them what had happened to me, basically. And one of the professors was still there that I had had before, and he was very supportive and very delighted at what he had said, that he hadn't heard all of those things at all before, what was happening. And yes, by all means, go for it. So I did, and I ended up with his recommendation and to do student teaching in a certain school and another school. And he said, it will be good for you later. And I remember saying, oh, but I'm going to have to travel 20 miles to get. It'll be worth it, believe me. But at any rate, at the end of it, they put me in the city that they gave. Because of the way they orchestrated my student teaching, you know, elementary and high school, I was able to get a job in the city I lived in because of them, which was really something, because I only had to go 10 minutes to work my kids were in middle school by then, and so it was no big deal. I was 40 when I stepped into my first classroom. But it took me that long to get settled. But I was so overjoyed at being able to put all of those things together. Mm-hmm. Now, this is the way I wrote it up. I decided, after exploring psychomotor therapy with Alan Diane Peso, dance therapy, art therapy, music therapy, that seeking educational credentials would make possible a wonderful career teaching art in the name of integrated arts. Back then, it was an evolving concept, not just in where I was, but out west, too. It was evolving. And the BU art staff encouraged me. I stepped into public classrooms at age 40 and left at age 73. I was having such a good time.
You found your spot.
They couldn't get me out. And the only reason I jumped out at 73, because I'd been running up and down stairs, three flights, several times a day, and my knees gave out. I had my knees. But I made it till 73. Now, not teaching just technical aspects of how to draw, but more important, creating, how to be creative is very different than teaching, you know, than teaching drawing. Right? And integrating the arts meant that I could, that I felt that I had the understanding of how to relate art to another teacher's classroom subject, science or math or whatever it is. They would determine, and they would ask, is this something that you can work in? And I'd think about it, and then before I put together something, and I'd go back. And then in the classroom, it was never, you know, you're going to draw. We're going to draw today. Follow me. Oh, no. Because I could use all of the techniques that I had learned. You know, you got a piece of paper, you got a pen ready. Okay, I'm talking up here, make some noise, or make something from this noise I'm doing. I don't care what it is, but do something. I mean, I could do all kinds of crazy things. But the thing was, in middle school, which is where I landed and didn't want to leave, because I was given the gift of wanting to be in middle school when I landed there. So I was there for years and years and years and years. I never wanted to leave. Now, I talk about in the very beginning, destiny and what was my other favorite word?
Synchronicity.
Synchronicity. Yeah. Isn't that crazy?
Well, you took a while to get there, but you found the right spot.
I sure did.
Maybe you could tell us what your fondest memories are of your life.
I looked at that question, and
it sounds like your teaching was really so meaningful to you.
Give me the question again. What was my favorite? What?
Fondest memory.
Oh, fondest memory. What number was that?
Four.
What did I do with four? Did I put four on the other page? Maybe that's it. Oh. Oh, my fondest memories. Yeah. Two children, being a mother and teaching middle school as an arts teacher, using expanded concepts. But, you know, having two little children
it's a sweet time of life.
Yeah, well, that whole, from the time I got married until the time, you know, my husband died, I was singing inside. That's all I can tell. I was very lucky.
Well, that's a perfect.
But it was a struggle to get there.
Yeah, but you got there.
Yeah.
So can you tell us about how you came to be at Raven's Landing? You told us that you were abducted. You came up here. So tell us the process of you getting into Raven's Landing. Was it kind of a done deal? Had your daughter already done it?
My daughter did everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all and how do you find living here?
Just like I did the moment I walked in, Susan was here. I walked in with my then 15-year-old companion, which helped the transition period from after my husband passed, because the three of us did everything after the two kids had, you know, moved on, as I say. And he was with me, and I went through a wonderful, successful, guided process of how to bring a little dog that wasn't a service dog up. And, you know, you prove that this dog is your companion. No, I wasn't my only companion. My husband was gone. I had no relatives. And so the doctor signed the paper. And when I walked in the door, Susan I don't know, my daughter, she happened to walk toward the door. I walked in, introduced ourselves. She leaned over to my dog, and she hugged that dog so warmly and so beautifully that I'll never, ever forget it. And then she hugged me. So that was my first experience, and nothing has changed.
It's been good.
It's been. My expression is, I never expected to live in the lap of luxury, but not the formal concept of luxury, but just the luxury of having so many, being surrounded by so many wonderful people and so many activities and everything. I was an outdoor cat. I never expected to live this way. But as an 88-year-old, I'm very grateful.
Good. And a fun and final question. What is or what was your favorite age?
Oh, from the time I married Joe McDermott until he passed. That's the only way
like
I can say.
Like you say, that was...
I was one of the fortunate earthwalkers.
Well, good. Sounds like you've had an incredible life, and I thank you for your time, and it's been a joy to get to know you.
Thank you very much.